Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for December 15, 2005. This is Doug Henwood in the special fundraising enhanced edition of Behind the News, where we look at the worlds of economics and politics most weeks at this time. I got two segments up for tonight. One, an interview, a live one in a few minutes with Leslie Harris, who is one of the editors of a collection called Slavery in New York. She's the editor, along with Ira Berlin, published in, by the New Press in conjunction with the New York Historical Society about that exhibition up at the New York Historical Society on the Upper West Side. We'll talk to her about the topic, slavery in New York. Then at the bottom of the hour, punctuated by lots of requests for cash, will be pieces of an interview I broadcast originally in August with David Roediger. He is a scholar on the invention of whiteness, the development of white consciousness, and he will be talking much about his most recent book, which is called Working Towards Whiteness, about how the whitening process for the immigrants who came to the United States in the late part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, who were shown the ropes of the American racial system, mainly by the Irish who preceded them. But, of course, we do have to ask for money. And actually, Michael, could we listen to a little bit of Julius Lester? Was that track five? Yes. Talking about, I used to listen to Julius Lester back when I was a young squirt growing up in New Jersey, and turning to WBAI for contact with the outside world and for the world beyond the suburbs. And I remember all these voices from the late 60s quite well. Let's listen to a little bit of Julius Lester.
I hate to sit here and sound as if I'm beating BAI's drum, but I really feel sometimes that the station is taken too much for granted, that such regular things as live music, live drama, I think people have come to accept and expect and not think anything of and not think anything extraordinary of them. And I think if there's one thing which I guess a lot of people have lost, and which I haven't lost even though I've been at this ridiculous place for 6 years now, is the sense of wonderment and awe that a place like BAI exists.
This is WBAI in New York City. Sorry as you may be to hear that. And my name has been James Ursay.
And that takes me way back to listening to Julius Lester on WBAI. And I never imagined back in, what was that, probably about 1967, 68, something like that, that I would be sitting in front of this microphone almost 40 years later doing the same thing and asking for your money. We do need you to pick up the phone and call 21. To that all mixed up oral history, or A-U-R-A-L, I guess, history of WBAI. Best of 20 tracks available with a $25 membership. We got Paul Robeson, Bob Fass, Julius Lester, Brother Marsh, Lou Hill, Samori Marksman, much missed personality, person, human being, voice, mind, spirit, all kinds of things. Multiply missed, great man, Samori Marksman. Also, Robert Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Bella Abzug, Oliver North. What's he doing here? George Bush, Saddam Hussein. Many, many, many delights there. 212-209-2950. As you can afford, 212-209-2950, the number to call. Let's take a little musical break and come back to speak with Leslie Harris. Thank you. All right, not a little bit, an excerpt from the Fugue No. 2 by Dmitri Shostakovich, as performed by Keith Jarrett. And a little bit more Shostakovich performed by Jarrett later in the program. And very nice response to those from the listening audience here. Nice pledge energy going on, 212-209-2950. And keep on calling, 212-209-2950. Don't make our volunteers suffer from boredom with a lack of labor while we're speaking with Leslie Harris, who will be joining us right now. Welcome to WBAI, Leslie Harris.
Hi, thank you.
Leslie Harris is a professor of history at Emory University in Atlanta and also a co-editor of the collection Slavery in New York, a collection of essays produced by the New Press. Very attractive volume about a very unattractive subject. And also tied in with an exhibition at the New York Historical Society, which I haven't gotten a chance to go to yet, but I will. It's up until March. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
So I suspect a lot of our listeners, unlike many other listening audiences, do know that New York has a rich history of slavery. But let's give us the capsule history. How did it start here?
Well, it started as it did in all of the 13 colonies in America, that the first settlers, one of the main ways that European settlers thought they could work the land and make the most of exploration here was through the importation of African slaves. And in New York, both the Dutch and the British wanted New York to be the slave trading capital of North America. So they not only imported slaves, they tried to make the ports into the main slave trading ports in North America. They were beat out at this game by Providence, but that was their goal throughout the 17th and 18th centuries.
And obviously, there were no. This is not a major agricultural center. So, what were slaves employed at doing?
Well, it wasn't a major agricultural center that we think of in the South, with plantation, you know, tobacco, rice, cotton, and cotton later in the 19th century. But there was agriculture here. Slaves were employed in everything in the economy in New York in the colonial era. They were the people who built the fort and the buildings of the first colony, New Amsterdam. They also worked the farms, the Bowery. That was a Dutch word for farms. And so when you think of the Bowery in New York, that's the area that was worked by slave labor for farms, initially for the settlers, but there were also there was also wheat and cattle that was farmed for European markets as well. So there was an agricultural economy going on as well here.
And so I gather the Dutch instituted slavery and then the British continued it?
That's correct.
And we're sitting on Wall Street, of all places, right now, and I believe that wall was built largely by slaves?
Absolutely. That's right. The Wall Street was built. And I think I just read an article that a deeper section of Manhattan, of the wall that surrounded Manhattan, was discovered recently when they were digging up the subways there just about a week or two ago. And that, I immediately thought, oh, that wall was probably built by slaves. They think it dates back to the late 17th century. And so that wall was probably constructed at least partially by slave labor.
So how many slaves were there, and what share of the population did they represent?
You know, you're talking about a very small population, but easiest probably to think about it in terms of percentages. In the, I think in the 17th century, about 30% of the population. In the 18th century, by the mid-18th century, about 20% of the population.
And what about the politics of slavery? How vigorous and extensive was an abolition movement, and when did that get started?
Abolition, you know, the thing about slavery, not only in New York, but really in the world, you know, the thing I always say is that freedom is the new thing on the block. But institutions like slavery, bondage, that those are really the way that human society was organized. So when you think about an abolitionist movement, those don't really start until you get New World slavery. In terms of New York and in terms of, say, the northern colonies, you get an active Quaker-based abolitionist movement in Pennsylvania from, I think, the first tract against slavery is in, I think it's 1688. But in New York is the last northern colony where the Quakers decide that slavery is wrong, for example. So whereas in other places, Quakers are the sort of forefront of the anti-slavery movement, in New York, they're the last group to do that. So an anti-slavery movement, the anti-slavery movement in New York, doesn't really kick off until after the Revolutionary War, when you have in other colonies stirrings of anti-slavery before that.
Yeah, what had the other colonies abolished slavery before the Revolution?
Let's see. The first one's Vermont in 1777, and you can imagine they didn't have very many slaves there, so it was sort of easiest for them to abolish slavery. And then New York is the last, along with New Jersey. New York in 1799, New Jersey in 1804. The other colonies in the 1780s, I think Pennsylvania around 1780, Massachusetts in the 1780s also passed laws that provide for the emancipation of slaves in one way or another.
Why was New York so retarded?
Well, I think New York took longer. It had the largest number of slaves. It had the most to lose economically. I think that that's the sort of the major reason. The Quaker influence that was in Pennsylvania, which is one of the which is probably the next largest, in terms of Philadelphia probably had the most slaves after New York, but the Quakers there were much stronger than they were in New York in terms of political influence. And then slavery, after the Revolutionary War, slavery in New York kind of picked up again as New York needed to rebuild after the Revolutionary War. It was occupied by the British. There was a lot of destruction. And slave labor was the way that some of that building took place.
Why are the Quakers so prominent in the anti-slavery movement?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The Quakers, initially made their money on slaves and on slave-based goods like sugar in the Caribbean and rum and things like that. And then they had a change of heart in the mid-18th century where they were feeling outcast. They were outcasts. They were religious outcasts. And historians argue that sense of being an outcast caused them to look inward and think about the ways in which, about other people, and have more sympathy for other people who are outcasts. And they began to look at the conditions of slaves in the Caribbean and in the U.S. and just began to think that this was wrong, that you don't treat other people this way. And as that movement took off, it sort of spread from congregation to congregation. That was their way of expressing their devotion to Christianity and to their religion.
We were talking a little bit about some degree of agricultural and kind of construction labor, but was there any kind of slave labor in industry, or what about domestic labor?
Yeah, the interesting thing about African-American labor in New York City is that under slavery, African-Americans could be found in every industry in New York City, everywhere. You had a large number of domestics, female domestics, also some men who served as butlers in the finest households. They were carpenters alongside white carpenters. They were skilled laborers, the men were. They worked on the docks. As slavery ended in New York, though, you have a de-skilling of the black population, so that ironically, blacks were more easily employed as slaves than they were as free people. And as free people, they began to be pushed out of skilled jobs as carpenters. There was a lot of struggle on the wharfs between white laborers and black laborers, and there's a real de-skilling of the black community as slavery ends.
I'm speaking with Leslie Harris, who is a professor of history at Emory University and also a co-editor of the collection Slavery in New York, recently published by the New Press. Why did that de-skilling happen?
There are a number of reasons. I think partly white laborers had always been suspicious of slave labor, had always worried that they would lose their jobs to slave labor, that employers would see slaves as cheaper and more easily controlled. So once blacks gained their freedom, whites continued to try to push them out. They then feared that blacks would be paid lower wages than whites would, and so they tried to push them out. Another reason is that white former slave owners who were still employers who then turned to wage labor, some of them were, they were embittered, or they didn't want to employ free blacks. They thought that, free blacks might in some way get beyond their place. There began to be a sort of discussion among employers and whites in general that blacks weren't good workers. They weren't as trustworthy as free people as they had been as slaves, so that was the implication. And so a sort of combination of growing racial stereotypes, white worker mistrust of black workers, not wanting to take them into their unions, all of that sort of made it more and more difficult for blacks to gain jobs.
Is that the early 19th century?
This is in the early 19th century.
Yeah, I'm going to hear a bit from David Roediger later talking about
some
of these issues,
yeah.
But I guess this is sort of provides some thematic unity here to the program.
Yeah.
And I imagine this is rather hard to trace, but what do we have any sense of what mix there is in today's New York black population? How many are descended from the original slaves here, and how many came from the South?
Well, you know, one of the authors in our book, Carla Peterson, wrote an essay, and she is a descendant of some of these early New Yorkers. Not necessarily, I'm not sure if she knows yet if it's of the early enslaved New Yorkers, but of the early free black New Yorkers. The thing about tracing back to slave roots in New York for present-day New Yorkers is that that's going to be a history that's held within families more so even than within the public record, I think. Once slavery ends in New York, there's a real silence about the fact that New York held slaves, really until almost the present day. I mean, every now and then, and so you people talk about it, but there's a real silence. And the other thing, New York today, as then, as now, is a place where there's just so much circulation and migration, so that people who are in New York, you know, for a census in 1820 are gone by the census of 1830, and maybe they come back, but it's hard to tell if this John Smith of 1820 is the same John Smith or John Smith's son in 1850. So it's very hard to trace. So I think that those stories, if people have those stories of families that can trace their roots back to a slave past, they need to bring those stories forward so that we can think of the exhibit in the book as really just the beginning of understanding what makes up today's black community in New York. The other thing, of course, we have an enormous migration from the South into New York, and we still see that, and migration of African-descended peoples from the Caribbean and from Africa itself. And so, you know, New York continues to be a melting pot in that way.
What's your interest in New York? Are you from here originally?
I'm not from New York originally. I'm from New Orleans originally.
Ah.
But I was always fascinated by New York, and I did my undergraduate work at Columbia, and then I went all the way to California to realize that I wanted to write a book on New York. So I actually wrote my first book on New York while I was a graduate student at Stanford in California.
And of course, this is all not a story of oppression. You have there's some chapters in the book about the development of a vigorous culture, mm-hmm. black culture. Could you talk a bit about what?
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the things about New York is a center of black religious culture. It has a large number of black churches that get founded as blacks gain freedom. They form their own churches. It's a lively cultural center in terms of music and the arts and dancing. We have an essay about that kind of culture that's going on, from fancy dress balls in the early 19th century to the sort of smoky joints, you know, where people are hanging out late at night. So it's a very vibrant place. I mean, New York in the 19th century was a beacon of freedom for many people. For northern blacks who were just gaining their freedom, they thought New York was a great place to come and congregate and reform their families. And then as the Underground Railroad starts up from the South, New York was a central way station on the Underground Railroad for blacks. And many blacks from the South, including Frederick Douglass for a time, stopped in New York as they were escaping the South, that New York was a place of freedom. It was known as a place of freedom.
And how did New York fit into the whole cotton trade? Obviously, cotton was very important for the development of, you know, British industry, but American finance in New York being the headquarters of American finance. How did the slave economy of the South affect the development of New York's, you know, mm-hmm. post-slave economy?
Yeah, it's a very, you know, New York is this very interesting place. It's really, you know, a city divided against itself. So on the one hand, for African Americans, it's this place of freedom. And a center of anti-slavery movement, that you have black and white abolitionists working together to end Southern slavery after slavery ends in New York. On the other hand, it's the main port. It's the main connection in the North for Southerners. Some people in the 19th century even called New York a kind of Southern city. There were so many Southerners in New York. Cotton, it was the main exporting station for cotton from the South. Most of the cotton, if not all the cotton in the United States, went through New York before going to Europe. But Southerners themselves traveled to New York as, you know, Southern plantation owners would bring their slaves, their personal servants with them when they came north to shop, to see shows. And the other thing about New York, in New York is a place where the first racist pamphlets were published. So not in the South, but the pamphlets that upheld slavery, that these were often published in New York. Books that claimed that blacks were inferior, these were often published in New York. So there's a very close relationship between the pro-slavery South and New York.
Yeah, it's very easy for Yankees to get in the moral high horse and denounce the Southerners for being so backward, but we Yankees were guilty of many crimes ourselves.
That's correct. Everyone was, you know, implicated to some degree, and so, you know, no need for anyone to be on any high horse anywhere.
I've only got a minute or two left, but tell us about the exhibit at the New York Historical Society, which is, of course, at Central Park West.
Mm-hmm. The exhibit, it's a, you know, wonderful exhibit, if I do say so myself. It's really, it takes some imaginative leaps. There are some wonderful artistic interpretations of things that we don't have visuals for, particularly in the early 17th century. We don't have pictures or portraits of early African-American New Yorkers, and so there are beautiful wire sculptures that give a sense of the kind of labor that New Yorkers in Dutch New York and in New Amsterdam might have done. And it goes right through to Emancipation Day, giving viewers a sense of the real variety of black life in New York, what it was like to be an enslaved person, what it was like to be free, what the relationship was between blacks and whites. There's a case in particular which holds the sort of furnishings of a typical middle-class home in New York. And through that furniture, through the commode, which was emptied every morning by a slave, you know, your night waste was taken out every morning by a slave, through the crib that was rocked by an enslaved nursemaid, you can see how intimately black and white lives were bound together in New York, that slavery is an intimate act, that you're talking about people who are often in small households together or in large households together, where slaves are responsible for the lives of white people, and white people are responsible for the lives of those slaves. And so you get a sense of that from this exhibit.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us, Leslie Harris. I'm sorry we couldn't go on longer, but we do have to ask for money.
I understand. I hope people give. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And I'm speaking with Leslie Harris, professor of history at Emory University in Atlanta, co-editor of the book Slavery in New York, published in October by the New Press. Her co-editor is Ira Berlin. We do have to now ask for some money. It'd be nice if we could. I guess it's about time to take a little station break. Should we do that, Michael?
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and this is WBAI in New York, also on the web at WBAI.org, where you can gaze at some of our other premiums if you're not satisfied with the merch on offer right now. But basically what we'd really love you to do is to pick up the phone and call 212-209-2950. Where apparently the premium that we're offering here is quite popular. The best of the WBAI, 20 tracks available, the $25 membership, everyone from Paul Robeson through Samori Marksman. Might be nice to listen to a bit of Samori. Do we have him available, Michael? Was it? So if while you look for Samori on this CD, the man who used to hold this time slot and who very generously gave me a program in this time slot and for which I'll be forever grateful, and a man who I will remember forever, a great program director here, a great human being, missed every day. 212-209-2950, the number to call, 212-209-2950, the number to call. Maybe let's take a little musical break while Michael's looking for Samori. Thank you.
I'm torn by the tragedy of seeing great people pass. Kind of make me sort of wonder. I mean, it kind of make us feel that it's our turn next, you know, because a lot of people who left town are people whom we knew. I look at many people like Stokely Carmichael, of course, Kwame Ture, and having known him and so on, it's touched me, and I just, looking at something early and saw his name again, and it just kind of reminded me about that there isn't much left for those of us who were around in the 60s, you know, with people like that. People like John Henry Clark, another personal friend who, you know, took so much with him. And many of the other figures who we looked at, many entertainers and you know, other people who made great contributions. And, you know, I'm ending with this sense of great loss, but I'm also ending on a tone of not only pondering and reflecting on these things, but being genuinely concerned.
And that's the voice of Samori Marksman, our much-missed leader here for many years. That's it for the MP3 version of the show. In the broadcast version, the rest of the hour was taken up with pleas for money, interspersed with excerpts from the interview I did with David Roediger that was originally broadcast in August of this year. You can listen to that interview in full by visiting my audio web archive at leftbusinessobserver.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, bye.